I found the quote from Adam Clark, and I'm going to read it. It's on page 16, and I don't know what edition this is, but it's an old one. And this is kind of in the middle of chapter 11, somewhere around, you know, what we're going to look at in a minute, very briefly. Mr. Clark writes, "It may be proper to stand a little here and reflect how particular and circumstantial this prophecy is concerning Egypt and Syria. From the death of Alexander to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, there is not so concise, comprehensive, and regular an account of these kings and their affairs to be found in any authors of those times. The prophecy, and note this, the prophecy is really more perfect than any history." I shouldn't have gotten in. "And is so wonderfully exact, not only to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, but likewise equally so beyond that time, that we may conclude in the words of the inspired writer, no one could thus declare the times and seasons, but he who had them in his own power." So, that was, and I think that's something for us to keep in mind. Now, with that, Brother Al at the break made a comment. As we look at these maps, to keep in mind that the king of the north will reappear, and I think, and it continues on till the end of the times. Actually, see, when we read in 11, chapter 11, verse 40 says, "In the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him." So, you know, we need to keep, I thought perhaps I'd covered that in a sense by saying that keep in mind foreshadowing events. That's as important a phrase as we can use and keep in our minds. Everything that has happened, you know, this is a famous saying in the world, isn't it? History repeats itself. And that's all we're really saying. But the history of this time is particularly important to us because in Daniel, we're given the detail of it. And as it occurred in from 323 to, I can use the date B.C. 30 if you'd like. In fact, I made a note of that to Brother Thomas speaking of that says that the king of the north went down, disappeared, was conquered, however you like to say it, in B.C. 67. In the south, it was 30. And we'll look at a little bit of that. And as I told you, I've debated all for many weeks as to whether I should go get this into from Brother Thomas or from Adam Clark. And I kind of concluded that I don't know. I don't know. But what we will do is this. If anybody, make a note in your records that it's worth looking at Adam Clark. I think we've already said and of course obviously Brother Thomas would be important to look at. Verse 5, "The king of the south shall be strong." Well, that is Ptolemy the first. "And one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion." That's turning pages, and Adam Clark is slow for me. From verse 5, Mr. Clark writes, this was Ptolemy Lagus. I think we've already termed him Ptolemy Soter the First, one of his generals who had the government of Egypt, Libya, and so forth, which are on the south of Judea. He was strong, for he added Cyprus, Phoenicia, Caria, and to his kingdom of Egypt, and so forth. He obviously added more. And one of his princes shall be strong above him. This was Seleucus Nicator, and he's also in your list of in your outline. Should be. Can't find my outline now. It is in your outline, right? Since I can't find mine. He should be the first one. Okay. Let me continue reading what he says. This was Seleucus Nicator, who possessed Syria, Babylon, Media, and his neighboring countries. This was the king of the north, for his dominion lay north of Judea. And that's just, you know, to note that we see the development of both those, of both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Yeah, that's your first king listed on the northern kings is Seleucus I Nicator, and that's who Mr. Clark, and I think Brother Thomas probably also would place those two as the first king of the south after we had the division of the empire and the wars that started with the Diadochi kingdoms. So we can remember that this is going to be no small warfare. And in fact, I think I should say it here because I'm going to forget it otherwise. They're fighting, I think the outline says it fairly well. It says from verse 5 to verse 29 is informed of the mutual rivalries, wars, and policies of the north and northern and southern horns of the goat from 312, 168 in the north, and from 323 to 169 in the south. Now remember, it took about 20 years for them to narrow it down to four. But notice how perfect, using Mr. Clark's word, is that this description is. And it only gets, it continues as perfect. Verse 6, and in the years of, and in the end of the years, they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall she stand nor his arm. Here we have Ptolemy II with probably Antiochus I, who is, some call him Theos, and others give him another name. But, you know, you can see what's happening. You know, they are having a marriage, and they're hoping that the daughter will swing her husband to follow her father, and therefore that would be united. But obviously that's not going to happen because Yahweh has now determined that. So you can imagine that the angels worked quickly and fastly with that marriage to get things to work out the way they should. And what was going to happen as we moved the Ptolemies were going to become weaker, but the northern kingdom would become stronger for probably a period of 100 years. Then, of course, the north would also become weak. Well, as the north and the south both became weak, what was going to happen? Problems from the west. Okay? Go west, we'll be at Rome. And so, you know, when we think of Rome suddenly in 30 or in 67, Rome had begun to become very formidable. by 200. So the Grecian kingdom was fading in both its northern and its southern horns. And as we talk about this, keep your mind cast toward the future, because you'll think of things that probably will suddenly open up to you, because this will be replayed. It may have a slightly different setting, but the point will be that the king of the south will weaken, the king of the north will grow stronger, then they both will become weaker, and Rome comes from the west. And now we're suddenly probably moving into a period that's perhaps even later than, it may even be after Christ is in the earth. So just to keep our minds focused, the final king of the north will be Russia. The final king of the south will be the rainbowed angel. Okay? Coming from Teman. Now that's jumping you way ahead, but I want to kind of confirm, in, at least for my own benefit, as much as anything, you know, the accuracy of these, and I'm going to do a short abbreviation of it, because some people may be interested in, well, I can do it off the outline. Verse 10 is speaking of Seleucus II and Seleucus III by those names Calenus and Serranus. Beginning in verse 10, also Antiochus the III appears. He's known as the Great, and we'll stand with him for a long time. He actually will be present for verses 10, 12, 13, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19. You know, so we talk about Antiochus Epiphanes, and by the way, there's a mistake in this, in that handout. Seleucus Philopater, for the beginning of his reign in the outline says 187. That should be 175. Okay. Then Antiochus Epiphanes we have in verses 21 through 29 and in verse 30. I think I'm saying that right. Now also, back in verse 5, as we've already said, we have Ptolemy the First. Verse 6, we have Philadelphus, Ptolemy II. I wrote mine in by the Ptolemy names. Ptolemy 3 is in verse 9. Ptolemy 4 is in verse 10 and verse 12. Ptolemy the 5th is in verse 16 and 17. Ptolemy the 6th is in verses 12 and 22 and 26. I think that's according to Brother Thomas. Ptolemy the 7th is in verse 27, 29. Ptolemy the 8th is in verse 27. And that's all I'm going to give you right now. That gives us, a fairly good feeling as to, you know, how much is given. Remember, we've said mutual rivalries. And, you know, obviously what would happen if one of these kings needed some help, he would, you know, marry into the other's tribe with one of his daughters and use her as a way to strengthen his own kingdom. You know, and that's what Daniel 11 says in a real nice way in verse 6. And in the end of the years they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. I'll give you, look, I would never be able to interpret what's being said, but I can rely on Brother Thomas or Adam Clark, either one. His Mr. Clark's statement. The king's daughter of the south, Berenice, daughter of Ptolemy Philadelphus, king of Egypt, was married to Antiochus Theos, king of Syria. These two sovereigns had a bloody war for some years, and they agreed to terminate it by the above marriage on conditions that Antiochus II would put away his wife Laodice and her children, which he did, and Berenice, having brought an immense fortune to her husband, all things appeared to go well for a time. But she did not retain the power of the arm. Her posterity shall not reign in that kingdom, but she shall be given up. Antiochus recalled his former wife, Laodice, and her children, and she, fearing that she might recall Berenice, caused him to be poisoned and her to be murdered, and set her son Callinicus upon the throne. And they brought her Egyptian women, striving to defend their mistress, were many of them killed. And he that begat her, or the margin says, he whom she brought forth, which is good as begat her, right? The son was murdered, as well as the mother, born of Laodice. So, you know, this is real heavy, but you can see what's going on. You know, these people play for keeps. And we're talking about, you know, look back to our what comes to your mind when you read that little story? Somebody answer that. Those that were playing back there could answer it. Think and make you think of Iraq and Iran today. The way they deal with their women and their bargaining for power is probably going on. It's, you know, this nice little territory here. Between the rivers, and when I use that phrase, I'm thinking between the Euphrates and the Indus, because it includes Afghanistan and Pakistan. So, you know, we've moved 25 centuries, and these people haven't changed at all. They're just like they were. Mystery, intrigue, murder, to maintain power and accumulate wealth. And yet we can use all that to identify the people. Now look, they did well during the 14th, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries AD, probably, because they dealt in silk, trading silk off to the west. But see, what was foretold effectively was that Rome was coming. Rome would come and destroy them. They destroyed them in trade. They also really didn't destroy them in religion, but they, in the sense that maybe Brother Darrell was using it the other day, that they adopted the Grecian gods. But remember, they changed the names, and when we look at the Muslim aspect of it, they really didn't. The West and the Muslims had a conflict because they had it over one God versus worshiping of the sun and the moon and the stars and whatever else they decided to worship. So see what we need to suddenly begin to get in our minds. It's three parties to this puzzle. It's the king of the north, and it's the king of the south, and it's when in Daniel 40 is him. Well, see, Brother Thomas goes through many, many pages to explain to us that him is Turkey. Okay? Well, Turkey, Constantinople being the major city of Byzantium as it once was, Istanbul as it's also been called. But once you get into this, you suddenly have put this whole eastern world together, but you got the problem still to the west in the personage of Rome. Rome, and you know, that's the thing that I like to say as I read through this stuff, Rome is coming. And you know, we can say that today. Doesn't matter what we see going on in Moscow, Saudi Arabia, Alexandria, Rome is coming. But has Rome now coming? Rome is not coming with legions like they did in the past. They're coming with religious doctrine. And that's where we should all know that ultimately, with the fall of Russia, and Daniel 11 is really dealing with ultimately the fall of this little horn of the goat, now Russianized. It will fall. It falls in Daniel 11:45. But that's phase one. Because by the time they fall, Rome papal has now become a military force because she has joined with Europe, who have given their allegiance to this king of the north, in our time Russia, but in a future time, when they fall, they will turn their look to Rome and join. And that's a time that we call the time of the Antichrist. Rome is glad to take them in. You know, interestingly enough, and the other night when we were talking about Daniel 2, I have a note. Remember, we've talked about Daniel 2 even this morning, because Daniel 2 is basic to everything we believe. But you know the difference in years between Daniel 2 and what Nebuchadnezzar commented, that the image being ground to powder and all those things that we know so fervently know. And that was a presentation of the kingdom of men to Nebuchadnezzar. Right? Now, Daniel 7 gives a presentation to Daniel of the beasts. They parallel, but there is a difference, because when we look at Daniel 5, Belshazzar, and I think you can calculate this very easily, it's 49 years, which is something that should ring in our bell, bring a bell in our head, that between the fall of Russia, the image, the plain of Dura, 49 years later, that Belshazzar, in that drunken orgy, and when we talk about a drunken orgy, what do we immediately think of? We think of the beast, the fourth beast, the Babylonian system. So if that type holds true, and I believe it will, we have a 40-year period between the fall of Russia upon the mountains of Israel and the fall of the fourth beast system. Okay? Now, I've taken us off on a long tangent, but I think it's important. It's important for me always to know the end of where I'm going. And I don't think that's a far stretch. I always use this in Richmond, and I say, you know, if I'm passing through Ashland, I know I'm going north. If I'm passing through Petersburg, I know I'm going south. So somewhat in the prophetical sense, I think we have to know where we're going if we know how we're going to get there. So, you know, when we begin to think of the king of the north and the king of the south, remember, they never change. But yet the name changes. The territory never changes. You know, it's not hard to figure this. All this territory is Russia. It will sweep down. Some way will join themselves, and they'll have this whole area. The king of the south will fade, but there's a stronger king of the south. Well, that will come from Teman, which I guess is somewhere in this area, and move northward toward Jerusalem. And that's the king of the north that's the king of the south for whom the final Babylonian system will fall. Just as Cyrus did away with the old Babylonian kingdom, Christ and the saints, the rainbowed angel, will do away with the Babylonian system 40 years later. If you want to say 30 years, because the apocalypse says the beast will, the 10 kings will give their authority to the beast for 1 hour. 1 hour, biblically speaking, is 30 years. So then the other 10 years, some people think it's the everlasting gospel. Some would say it's the time of the judgment seat. My preference would be to think it's the time of that particular 10 years. I also believe the judgment seat takes 10 years, but probably the everlasting gospel is 10 years also. So that's really 50 years. Quote, 49 years. It's a jubilee period. So, you know, that's more than I can really comprehend, but I hope it comes through fairly clearly. All right, now we're back to the kings of the north and the kings of the south. In the 200s, we're coming closer. We'll jump to verse 13. But the king of the north, that's Antiochus the Great, in 198 B.C. conquered Palestine and called Syria, as set forth in verse 13. That's kind of what Brother Thomas says. For the king of the north, that's Antiochus the Third, shall return, shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And in these times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. He's now Ptolemy the Fifth. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish division, but they shall fall. 15. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. First, these are summary notes from Brother Thomas. On verse 14, he says, the infant king of the south, he's 5 years old, Ptolemy the Fifth, called Epiphanes, he reigned from 205 to 181. His guardian became His guardians became the Romans. Therefore, the Romans entered the Middle East, affairs of Egypt, Syria, and the Holy Land. So remember, we said earlier, the Romans were coming. Here's where we have a distinct verse referencing to us the coming of the Romans. The northern king, Antiochus the Great, was checked in the 190s. The southern king, Ptolemy Epiphanes the Fifth, was weak, about 190. Rome was progressing. And I have a note here, and I'm not going to take time to read it. But if you look in Brother Mansfield's book of Daniel on page 306, maybe I will look at it. When I start skipping, I usually skip something I shouldn't skip. So, Brother Mansfield says this. This is under, speaking of the robbers. He says, a new power is now introduced as Gabriel addresses Daniel personally. The people, the Jews, in the West was rising a small power that was destined to increase rapidly in strength and vigor until it should control the affairs of the world and exert a mighty influence among the nations. It was the power of Rome. So, see, Rome is in the picture as we approach the 15th, 16th verses of Daniel 11. Okay, 16 says, Antioch, and I'm not going to read the scriptures, I'm just going to tell us what Brother Thomas tells us it means. Antiochus the Third comes against Ptolemy the fifth, Epiphanes, and take Syria and the Holy Land. This war was for all practicality ended the influence of the south, that is, the Egyptian influence in the Holy Land. It's Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great. Strangely enough, and we might just keep it in mind, Antiochus the Great, the third, was somewhat of a friend to the Jews. I mean, he was not, his son would be a terror, Antiochus Epiphanes, and we want to probably move to that because I want to have a little bit on the, verses 22, kind of forward. There are the conflicts from 175 to 164 between the northern king, Antiochus Epiphanes, and the southern kings, Ptolemies 5 and 6. With the victory finally, after many contests, the king of the north shall successfully remove the king of the south. That was a battle between Antiochus the 4th and Ptolemy the 6th. Let me go back to Mr. Clark for a minute. I'll tell you why Brother Thomas drops Adam Clark because when he gets to the Maccabean period, Mr. Clark gets way off and suddenly thinks that the Maccabees were typical of the church. And if we read through that, you probably can understand why he would arrive at such a conclusion. I really don't know why, but you know, we give him a little bit of slack. So Brother Thomas, of course, drops him like a hot potato, and looks at the Maccabean period, and I want us to have a little bit of time on the Maccabean period before we end this second period. So on 26, this is Mr. Clark's statement. Let's read 26 in the scriptures. It says, "Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall ever flow, and many shall fall down slain." Well, his is Antiochus the Fourth, and here is Mr. Clark's commentary. This is proof that what has been noted, that the intrigues of Antiochus corrupting the ministers and officers of Ptolemy were the cause of all the disasters that fell on the Egyptian king. That they fed on the portion of his meat who were in his confidence and pay and possessed the secrets of the state betrayed him. And those were the means of destroying him and his army so that he was defeated as was before observed. And both these kings' hearts shall do mischief, as verse 27. That is Antiochus IV and Ptolemy Philometor, who was the nephew to the former, and whose interest he was pretended to have much at heart, since the Alexandrians had renounced their allegiance to him, and had set his younger brother, Ergates, upon the throne. When Antiochus came to Memphis, he and Philometor had frequent conferences at the same table, and at these times they spoke lies to each other, Antiochus professing great friendship to his nephew and concern for his interest, yet in his heart designing to ruin the kingdom by fermenting the discords which already subsisted between the two brothers. On the other hand, Philometor professed much gratitude to his uncle for the interest he took in his affairs, and laid the blame of the war upon his minister, Eulaeus, while at the same time he spoke lies, determining as soon as possible to accommodate matters with his brother and join all their strength against the deceitful uncle. But it shall not prosper. That's again in verse 27. Neither succeeded in his object, for the end of the appointed time was not yet come. Again, see, you know, that helps us, it helps me at least to go back and realize that, you know, Yahweh is in control and we know what he's working to. Yahweh is working to Rome being by 67, 60 BC, ready to take over as the major empire in the world and to prepare for the birth of his son. See, so the angels are busy at work manipulating these horrible people to his end. Point that we must remember that it's Yahweh in control through the Elohim accomplishing his purpose. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time on the Hasmoneans, that is the Maccabees. I guess I need to make one other point. See, the Romans getting into this fray was what really infuriated Antiochus Epiphanes. And that's why he caused this terrible strife and grief upon the land of Israel. See, his Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth, that's Antiochus the Fourth, he was a major influence, and he did not want Rome entering in. He did not want troubles in any of his empire. He resented the South and what they were doing, and as the South, I suppose he blames, and they perhaps were involved in some of it. And I think that mostly because it applies so well in our day. You know, who's the kind of the tack in the shoe in the Middle East today between the Arabs and the West? It's the state of Israel, right? And I think in a way the Maccabees, just prior to the Maccabees, maybe even the father, I think his name was Mattanias, he was probably leaning to help the Romans because he thought the Romans would be better for Israel than would be the Grecians. I think I said that right. In other words, the Seleucids, who were now getting the upper hand. You know, it's a little bit, again, keep thinking about foreshadowing. What's Israel's position today? Who do you think they're really worried about? I can tell you because I was there, 1980, when the Iraqis and the Iranians were fighting. The word amongst the Jewish military, the Israeli military, I should say, was, let them fight. The more they kill each other, the less we've got to worry with in the future. And I heard a general say one day to a group of Americans, American Jews, plus me, I was incognito. They said, we don't worry about the Iranians or the Iraqis. You keep them doing whatever they're doing. You watch Russia because we fear Russia. They further said, you know, these others we can knock out in a minute. And don't think I didn't think about that when they took out the Baghdad nuclear facility. 2 minutes over Baghdad, a book that we should all probably read, if you have time to read. But, you know, they took it out, and recently, I should have next period, but I'll give it this period because it's now in my mind. April 25th, and I didn't see the April 25th story, but I heard it rerun on, I think it's CNBC. Chris Wallace. It's a story entitled "The Iranian Nuclear Threat," and it was fantastic. The girl that interviewed Prime Minister Sharon in Jerusalem, she asked him, you know, what do you think about all this? And you know, and you can't imagine how well within his interview, they talked to the guy that dropped the bomb that wiped out the Baghdad nuclear facility in Baghdad in 1980. Scott may help me with the date. But anyway, they interviewed him, and then they also interviewed Sharon. And Sharon said, you know, in a nice sort of a way, he says, you know, we know how to take care of nuclear threats. Very confidently, very, I don't want to use the word arrogant because I happen to like the guy. Yeah, casual. I mean, you know, we can handle that. Well, see, that's, I think, that in a sense talks about the Maccabees. And I believe, this is a personal belief, but I think it conforms with what the scriptures teach. I think the Maccabees typify in our day the nation of Israel in a latter day conflict. Now, you know, the Maccabees, they had a lot of victories. They didn't eventually win the war. But that was a period of from 168 to 161. I don't know where I can get anything on that. Well, I'm just going to read you as much as I have in my notes. This is really spoken of in verses 30 through 35 of Daniel 11. It's a Maccabean period, and that probably everybody has that marked in their Bible. It typifies the latter days. I put a question mark behind that, but I think it is typifying probably even some days that we've already been through or seen. Speaking to the Maccabees, they realized that Yahweh, that is the Elohim, were their helpers. And I think that's true. I mean, if you read enough on Judas Maccabeus, he effectively says that Yahweh is in their army. He has led them. The Israelis say the same thing. They probably say Adonai, or they may say God, or they may say the Almighty, or they may have another name, but they understand a fair amount. The victories were significant, but as Israel will not be the fulfillment only in the event of the far greater victory. So Israel is not going to win this battle, and neither is the USA or the Anglo powers. This battle is eventually going to be won by the rainbowed angel. I want to go to Light for the Last Days for just a moment. This was written, by the way, in 1887 by Grattan Guinness. And his first chapter is called The Daniel Parallel. And I think some of it is probably, we don't need to read, but there was some of it that I did want to read. And I'm probably not going to be able to put my hands on all the pages in the order that I want anyway. So, let me give you 4 points that Mr. Guinness comes up with. By the way, this was written in, I think I just said it, but I've forgotten it. 1887 is close enough. He lived to about 1925. And he predicted in his book the return in 1919, of course, which he was wrong. But I think it's a couple things we need to kind of think about. four things right here. He says that in prophecy, that in symbolic prophecy, a day is a symbol of a year and a time of 360 years. That Daniel's prophetic visions of the fourfold metallic image and of the four beasts have been fulfilled in the histories of the Babylonian, Persians, Grecians, and Roman empires. Three, that the Babylon the Great in Revelation 17 is a Roman Catholic Church. Four, and this is where we are particularly today, that the little horn of Daniel chapter 7 represents the papal dynasty, and the little horn of chapter 8 is in its final formation, the Mohammedan power, the one arising out of the Roman Empire and ruling in Western Europe, the other arising out of one of the divisions of the Greek Empire and ruling in the East, in Eastern Europe and in Asia. So that's where Mr. Guinness was. We got 1 minute, and I want to just read something else. This is just for the benefit of whoever would like to understand it. He says, we are now living in the time of the end of the Gentile age. The millennium itself, with its introductory and closing events, may be regarded as the time of the end of the entire story of man's redemption and restoration in full fellowship with God. For we must repeat that though the, and I'm going to change that word to ecclesia, he says church, has reached her full perfection prior to the commencement, the rest of the redeemed do not do so until it's closed. To mankind at large, the millennial reign is indeed the Sabbath of its long week of sin and sorrow, toil and suffering, a bright earnest of the full blessedness which awaits it in the new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. But it is nevertheless widely different from the perfected condition. For not until it is over, and until the final judgment of the wicked and the destruction of the diabolus and of death, is it said of the state which is to succeed the millennium and last forever, that there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. From the glorious millennial reign is closed by a fresh outbreak of rebellion and apostasy, bringing down fresh judgments and destructions. But in the new heavens and in the new earth, such experiences are forever excluded. The blessedness of the nations of the saved is never again to be disturbed by sin and the diabolus, by death and judgment. In the eternal kingdom there will be no more curse, but unbroken peace and joy in perfected fellowship with God in paradise restored in the new earth. You can see what Brother Mr. Guinness says. So I think, you know, it really gives us a picture, and we are really, I think when we look at Daniel 11, we really begin to see so much that is being presented to us in a very foreshadowing events. I hated to go through verses 5 through 29 in such haste. Also, I may have a little bit more to say about the Maccabeans, but right now, if nothing else, let's keep in mind that the Maccabean era has probably been being and has been enacted since the birth of Israel. And you remember, Israel's had a lot of victories. They've had a lot of, I don't want to call them defeats yet, but the defeats will yet come, as it did to the Hasmoneans, the Maccabeans, however you like to prefer that. Okay? We'll take a